Even before the election, Donald Trump's rise to power had been compared, either subtly or overtly, to Adolf Hitler's rise in 1930s Germany. But are those comparisons fair or just hyperbolic? Joining us now is Daniel Ziblatt, a professor of government at Harvard University and author of the forthcoming book, Conservative Parties and the Birth of Modern Democracy in Europe. And Daniel, before we get to talking about some of these comparisons that people are making, I want to just go back and talk about the rise of Hitler and how he came to power. First of all, remind us about the economic and political climate in Germany back at that moment.
Yeah, well, there are a couple of really important conditions that gave rise to the emergence of Hitler as a political leader, then also how he took power. One of the key things that one has to keep in mind is that Germany had just lost the war, World War I, right, and millions of people had died. And, you know, 4% of the population, I mean, way beyond anything the United States experienced. So there was a kind of sense of trauma in the population. And then this coupled with the economic crisis that came several years later, these are the conditions under which these kind of appeals that Hitler made really found mass following.
And the economic crisis that you're talking about made worse by the fact that the U.S. stopped investing in Germany.
Yeah, so the Great Depression came in 1929, and so this was a serious economic shock. But I think one of the things that's also important to keep in mind is that the rise of Hitler wasn't driven just by war and economics. There was a kind of set of political preconditions, and in a way, the immune system of the German political system was already lowered, I would argue, before 1929.
What do you mean by that?
So two main things, I think. One, there had been a kind of long-term decay in the main conservative party in Germany. So the kind of Tory conservative party, it was a kind of constitutional center-right party, ambivalent about democracy, had kind of played the democratic game in the mid-1920s. But by the end of the 1920s, had radicalized and kind of fallen apart. And this created an opening on the right.
And Hitler took advantage of that opening. How and when did he appear on the scene?
Well, he was initially on the scene kind of as a rabble-rouser in Munich in the early 1920s, had been arrested at the Beer Hall Putsch, had written his memoirs, Mein Kampf, but in some sense was a kind of marginal character, and his political party was marginal. And we sometimes forget that the Weimar system was actually dominated by the Social Democratic Party with full democratic credentials throughout this period. So the, in some ways, the political system looked to be very booming at some level in the early 20s. And it was really only after the collapse of this center-right party in 1928 and then the Great Depression, 1929, that Hitler really began to have his breakthroughs in 1930, 1932.
And was there something about his personality that people were attracted to in those early days?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it was both his personality as well as his movement. And he was, the classic demagogue and was able to play to the audience and to kind of adjust his message based on what the audience wanted. So certainly that was a big part of it. But I really think that a key part of the story was there was an opportunity there with the kind of vacuum on the right side of the political spectrum combined with the economic crisis and the kind of trauma of war created an opportunity for somebody like him to come along.
And he didn't come to power railing against Jews, right?
This was part of his appeal. I mean, there's no question that he was an anti-Semite, and it was very clear from the outset. But this was only one part of the kind of appeals that he was making. He was also making appeals about nationalism, making, restoring Germany's position in the international system. And so it was a kind of nationalist appeal as well as an economic appeal.
So he was appointed chancellor by the president, Paul von Hindenburg, in 1933. And then in 1934, Hindenburg died and there were no new elections. Why not?
Yeah, so really, I mean, I think the way he came to power in some ways contains some of the most instructive lessons for us today when we look back. He was included in the initial coalition in the cabinet in 1933 by Hindenburg, although President Hindenburg despised him and really looked down upon him. He was a kind of corporal and Hindenburg was a general. And he included him very much kind of opportunistically with the idea, well, we'll keep him contained, we'll control him. And this is the only way to kind of put the right in power. The right had fallen apart, as I was saying before 1933. And so the only way to kind of keep the Social Democrats out of power was to place him in power. And once Hitler was in power after January 1933, I mean, I think the game was basically up. I mean, it was a kind of slow process of squeezing German democracy until by the end of 1933, it was really no longer in existence.
Well, one of the things that was done that a lot of people look back on as a key moment was the burning of the Reichstag, the parliament building, which was blamed on a young communist. Is there historical consensus about whether that was completely false?
Yeah, and I think most people think that that was, in fact, a kind of forged event. I mean, that this was an event created for the political benefit of the Nazi Party to consolidate power.
And how did they consolidate power right after that?
there was a kind of general slow-term squeeze on the freedom of press was restricted. The ability of parties to kind of show up in the parliament was restricted. The Nazis would show up in parliament in their uniforms and gradually just made the political environment so that it was essentially no longer a functioning democracy.
Okay. So we've heard a little bit about the rise of Hitler there. So let's talk about these comparisons that some people are making, some very overtly, some more subtly, between Hitler and Trump. Do you think that there's anything there?
Yes, certainly the comparison's in some sense very inflammatory. So one has to really work, as one thinks about this, in a very careful way. And I think the first thing to do is to think about the differences, because there are substantial differences. Number one, as I've said, that the kind of wartime trauma is something that Germany experienced in 1918 that the U.S. didn't experience then and certainly is not experiencing now. The second major difference, I would say, was that the U.S. is a much older democracy in a much older country than Germany was in 1920s, 1930s. I mean, we know, of course, that Germany was a new democracy in 1918, but we sometimes forget that Germany was actually a relatively new country, only being founded in 1871, so 50 years earlier. It was really a brand new country. So in this sense, I think American democracy is certainly more robust than German democracy was at that point. And then a third big difference that I think, you know, we just have to put on the table is that the kind of nature and the scale of the challenge was greater. I mean, in some sense, Adolf Hitler and fascism in general was a kind of very coherent attempt to overturn democratic political systems. Populists today, I think Donald Trump counts as a populist along with Marine Le Pen in France and the UKIP party in Great Britain. These are all populist movements.
And the difference between populist and fascist is what?
I think that populists in some sense kind of represent a kind of low-grade fever of democracy in the sense that there's a kind of latent problem in democracy. And this can sometimes break out and be a serious crisis of democracy, but there's no real effort to overturn democracy by contemporary populists. So in that sense, the challenge is not as significant. That being said, I think there are some real similarities that one should point to, though.
Well, and let's listen to a little bit of Donald Trump and the things that have alarmed people and made them make these comparisons.
Donald J. Trump is calling for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States until our country's representatives can figure out what the hell is going on.
I alone can fix it. I will restore law and order to our country.
We're going to open up those libel laws so that when the New York Times writes a hit piece, which is a total disgrace, or when the Washington Post, which is there for other reasons, writes a hit piece, we can sue them and win money instead of having no chance of winning because they're totally protected.
We will make America strong again. We will make America proud again. We will make America safe again. And we will make America great again. God bless you and good night. I love you.
So you hear they're going after a group of immigrants in this country, sort of attacks on freedom of the press, nationalism. What do you hear there? And do you see why some people hear that and make this comparison?
Yeah, again, I mean, there are striking similarities in the kind of language that populists and fascists use, but I think it's important to distinguish the two in the sense that although, you know, there's a participation in democratic elections, a willing up for populists, a willingness to accept the results of elections, but kind of playing with this issue, so it's dangerous. So there are similarities. And I just would emphasize two main points, I guess. One, that in both instances, in both Weimar Germany and today, I think the rise of this kind of right-wing populism emerges as conservative parties fall apart. And so there's a kind of sometimes a kind of fantasy of maybe social democrats and liberals that as conservative parties fall apart, this will mean triumph for social democracy and liberal parties. But in fact, what happens when conservatism falls apart is you get this kind of language, you get this kind of movement, and you get this kind of politics. The second point is that all of this is a response to a perceived dysfunction in the political system. And so this is another kind of commonality, I guess, both in Weimar Germany and the United States. I mean, so there's a kind of long-term slow decay often people point to in the American political system, congressional dysfunction, the rise of executive orders, and there's a kind of perception that a single individual needs to step in to kind of solve problems. And so I think institutional dysfunction, both in the Weimar system, where one also found this, and today, gives rise to kind of this temptation to have a single leader solve all of our problems for us.
In terms of comparing a U.S. politician to Hitler, this is not new. This is something that has happened. We remember it with George W. Bush and with Barack Obama. There were those posters of him with a Hitler mustache. On the one hand, you think it's very dangerous to make that comparison because Hitler was so uniquely bad. On the other hand, some people would say, well, you don't want to miss the comparisons if there are comparisons, because once you do, it's too late.
Yeah, no, this is exactly the dilemma that somebody like myself faces. So I've been writing a book on conservative parties throughout history. And I guess that the way I think about this is that conservatism itself in some ways contains a dilemma, which is that it can sometimes degenerate into right-wing populism. The form that the right-wing populism takes varies, certainly. And in some instances, it can kind of veer out of control into a kind of fascism that is much more dangerous. In the contemporary setting of the United States and Western Europe, we're not facing that kind of challenge, but we are seeing the same dynamic in the sense that we're seeing conservative parties degenerating, declining appeal, declining organization, and this kind of populism pops up in its wake. And so being alert to the differences as well as the similarities is, I think, really something very important for all of us to do.
Daniel Ziblatt is a professor of government at Harvard University who studies Weimar Germany. Daniel Ziblatt, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.